Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, December 16th, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on defending education versus Olentangy Local School District Board of Education in this litigation update. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Matthew Hoffman, who serves as legal counsel on the appellate advocacy team at the Alliance Defending Freedom, where he represents ADF clients for state and federal appellate courts, including before the U.S. Supreme Court. Previously, he served in ADF Center for Free Speech and Center for Academic Freedom. And in those roles, he represented clients in free expression cases across the country and has argued before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh and Ninth Circuits, as well as the Alabama Supreme Court. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Krista Bowman, who is a trial lawyer specializing in First Amendment, defamation, and civil liberties work. She's the founder and managing attorney at Bowman Law PC. Her cases have touched on extending fair procedure rights for students expelled based on their speech, challenging the constitutionality of policies stifling citizens' speech in city council meetings, and online defamation cases. She serves on the San Francisco Bar Association's litigation section and is the membership chairperson of the First Amendment Lawyers Association. And I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens. Throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining today. Ms. Bowman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kayla. Good afternoon and good morning for us West Coasters. It's a pleasure to be here to moderate today's litigation update on parents defending education versus Olentangy Local School District with my fellow panelists and today's subject matter expert, Matthew Hoffman. It's obviously a fascinating case, and we've got lots to cover, so we'll dive right in. Matthew, could you give our audience, to start off with, some factual backgrounds on the Olentangy case? How is the school district proposing to regulate student speech, and what was the controversy that spurred the case?
Sure. Thanks, Krista. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone today. So Defending Education, which is the group formerly known as Parents Defending Education, filed suit on behalf of its members, who are parents in Olentangy School District, whose children desire to use pronouns consistent with biological sex based on their religious and scientific beliefs. Defending Education emphasized that the parents' children, bore no ill will to those classmates who identified as transgender and wanted to be referred to by pronouns inconsistent with sex, but their religious and scientific convictions just could not simply not allow them to use pronouns inconsistent with sex. And so the key evidence in this case, and the dispute arose when a member, a parent member of Defending Education, sent an email to the school district asking whether her child, the parent's child, would be subject to discipline for using pronouns inconsistent with sex. And the school district essentially said yes. There's a little bit of a dispute about this in the opinion, but basically what the counsel for the school district said was that purposely referring to another student by using gendered language that student knows is contrary to the other student's identity would be an example of discrimination under board policy. And in a subsequent email, counsel for the school district also then said that the school district would consider accommodations for using pronouns when doing so would be contrary to the child's religious beliefs. Because counsel did not identify which policy the use of pronouns consistent with sex would violate, Defending Education filed suit against two of the school district policies and the code of conduct, and specifically the provisions pertaining to harassment, bullying, discrimination based on gender identity, which could kind of trigger this pronoun obligation.
That's great. So I know this case sort of was heard many different times. Can you talk to us about the procedural posture, including what record was before the en banc appeal, and what exactly, by the time the en banc appeal rolled around, what relief was Defending Education requesting?
Right. So soon after filing suit, Parents Defending Education filed for a preliminary injunction in the district court, which the district court denied. They then appealed, and a divided panel, 2-1, affirmed the denial of the preliminary injunction. The Sixth Circuit then voted to take it en banc. And so the decision, the en banc decision, is a review of the denial of a preliminary injunction motion. So this case is still very early, you know, even though it's been going on for years now, still at this procedural posture is very early, without any discovery, you know, before the en banc court. So the only record was the exhibits filed for the preliminary injunction motion. And the majority opinion notes that the school district did not provide any evidence about any impact of using pronouns. The other kind of wrinkle in it was during the pendency of the litigation, the school district amended a couple of its policies that Defending Education had sued over. So then they then argued, the school district argued that the case was moot based on those policy changes. The Sixth Circuit in its jurisdictional section said it wasn't moot, but based on the update to those policies, the Defending Education changed the relief requested from, you know, being able to use pronouns consistent with sex to asking for a preliminary injunction that would bar the school district from punishing students for using biological pronouns to refer to transgender and non-binary individuals without any subjective ill will towards those individuals. So the majority and the dissent both frame this as an injunction against enforcing the policies to prohibit so-called misgendering are using pronouns consistent with sex. And that was the modified relief that was at issue for the en banc court.
Great. So this was a 17-judge en banc panel with a majority opinion written by Judge Murphy, separate concurring opinions by five circuit judges, a dissenting opinion by Judge Stranch, with which I believe six judges concurred. So from all of that writing, we're going to try to distill the main holdings of the case. So let's start with the standard of review. So the court discussed several different First Amendment standards that could potentially apply. They talked about Hazelwood's deferential test for school-sponsored speech, Barnett's test for compelled speech, and of course, Tinker. Which First Amendment standard did the Sixth Circuit end up applying, and why did they do that?
Right. So the short answer to your question is the Sixth Circuit applied the Tinker standard for personal student expression. But as you know, the opinion, just the majority opinion alone, is lengthy, not including all the concurrences and then the long dissent. There really was some lively discussion on this issue. And the majority opinion gives a pretty comprehensive overview of the Supreme Court cases on student speech and discussing how they do or do not apply in the situation. So I think it'd be helpful just kind of go into some of that background to talk about these cases, because there is a limited universe of student speech cases that the lower courts have applied. And so it's helpful to have these reviews to see how these kind of principles interact, because while students, you know, the Supreme Court has said students do not shed their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gate, the First Amendment certainly applies in a modified fashion within public schools. So the Sixth Circuit reviewed numerous of the Supreme Court cases, and not really in chronological order, which is often how it's done. But initially, the Sixth Circuit carved out the speech doctrine from Hazelwood School District versus Kohlmeier, and differentiated that from student personal expression. So the Hazelwood case involved a school-sponsored newspaper that was part of the educational curriculum. It was part of a journalism class. And the court said that the school could exercise control over articles, you know, basically editorial discretion, so long as its discretion was reasonably related to a legitimate pedagogical interest. But that, the Sixth Circuit said, relates to curricular speech, not students' personal expression. And the court then went on to more of those student personal expression cases, which are Bethel School District number 403 versus Frazier and Morse versus Frederick, which established that schools can regulate student expression that is vulgar and lewd. In the Frazier case, the student wanted to give a vulgar graduation speech, I believe. And then in Morse, the court said that schools could regulate student expression that advocates illegal drug use. So those are particular instances of students' personal expression, which schools have traditionally regulated and which the court said they could do consistent with the First Amendment. And then the Sixth Circuit discussed Tinker, which other circuits have held, and I think the Sixth Circuit in prior cases too, basically gives the default rule for student speech. And that also default rule can be seen in the most recent Supreme Court school student speech case, which is Mahanoy Area School District versus BL. And that is the general protection for students' personal expression. We can get into some of the exact details of it later, but that's basically the general protection. And then the final precedent that the Sixth Circuit analyzed was the oldest one, a case during World War II, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but it established the protection against compelled speech, even in lower schools. And so that case involved West Virginia's rule that required school children to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance. It was challenged by Jehovah's Witnesses. And the Supreme Court said that the Jehovah's Witness children could not be disciplined for refusing to salute the flag because that is compelling orthodoxy, compelling belief in a certain view that the Jehovah's Witnesses didn't agree with. And so that case applied in lower schools and establishes a protection against compelled speech. I think that I'll leave that summary of the school speech doctrine there. The second part of your question, Krista, went to why did the Sixth Circuit choose the Tinker standard? And it did so because it viewed the student's pronouns or the choice of pronouns which to use as the student's personal expression. There's no claim to this by the school district that the use of pronouns was pursuant to curriculum, such as to involve Hazelwood scrutiny. And that's an interesting distinction because in the public employer context, which is slightly different, these pronoun policies have also arisen. And that there are arguments there that, that it would be government speech when you're using these pronouns. But in this case, there are no such concerns because it's even outside of class, the anti-harassment and bullying policies apply. And so it's student personal expression. And then secondly, the majority found that the kind of vulgar or lewd speech line of cases did not apply because there's nothing inherently offensive about vulgar about the use of personal pronouns. I think in some instances, the use of pronouns consistent with sex or inconsistent with sex could rise to the level of bullying or harassment, which the Sixth Circuit opinion, leaves room for the school to regulate, but just the use of them with no subjective ill will towards anyone is not inherently offensive. That's how it's been done historically, use of pronouns consistent with sex. And so what protection applies is the Tinker standard. Related to that, the concurrences kind of take aim at the majority for not discussing other ways to dispose of the case, such as the Barnett line for compelled speech and the bar in viewpoint discrimination. So the majority opinion kind of avoided the compelled speech issue because it said the district offered an accommodation, so it wasn't clear if it was actually compelling speech. And then secondly, it was kind of agnostic on whether the Tinker standard prohibits viewpoint discrimination, which some of the concurrences said it did. So the concurrences are engaged in a little criticism of the majority, light criticism, I'd say, because they think that the school district could theoretically regulate the use of pronouns consistent with sex under Tinker and prohibit it if they have met their evidentiary burden, which I think we're going to discuss upcoming. But if the majority applied the absolute prohibition on compelled speech or viewpoint discrimination, then the school's action here would be unlawful almost as a per se matter, and they couldn't meet any level of scrutiny there.
So having decided to apply Tinker, I want to talk a little bit about what the court held about what Tinker specifically requires. And the court talked about a substantive constitutional element to this, and as well as a procedural perspective with regard to the burden of proof. So maybe if you could start with, what were the substantive constitutional questions the court was looking at when applying Tinker?
Sure. So in the Tinker case, which is the Supreme Court case from 1969, I believe, which involved students wearing black armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War, it established basically two prongs: that school officials can regulate speech if the speech will either cause a substantial disruption or infringe on the rights of others. So there are two prongs there: substantial disruption and infringe on the rights of others. So the majority then proceeded to analyze the substantive constitutional questions of what is a substantial disruption and what qualifies as an invasion of the rights of others, so as to allow Tinker scrutiny. And then there's the procedural question, which the majority discussed subsequently. So the first one there is what qualifies as a substantial disruption under Tinker. So what the majority said here is that Tinker did not address the situation when schools may ban speech that is not inherently disruptive, but that causes a disruption because of the audience's reaction to it. And so in Tinker didn't really have cause to reach this question because there wasn't really evidence that these passive expression of wearing black armbands would cause disruption to classes or other things. So it didn't really address that kind of heckler's veto argument. The Sixth Circuit majority noted that the First Amendment in general does not allow for a heckler's veto, which is the prohibiting speech because of the audience's reaction to it, because it's viewpoint discriminatory. If people simply don't like what you say and then cause a ruckus or cause disruption themselves because they don't like what you say, they're effectively vetoing your viewpoint. And in general, under the First Amendment, the Supreme Court has indicated that viewpoint discrimination is almost per se unlawful when the government does it. And so if the government stops speech because of anticipated disruption, that would be viewpoint discriminatory. But the Sixth Circuit noted, as I kind of indicated up front, that modified First Amendment rules apply in the school context. And that's because schools have a captive audience of immature students. And historically, that's kind of been justified as schools have both tutelary and custodial responsibilities. There's the notion of the in loco parentis delegation of authority from parents to schools, that the educator is stepping in as a parent when the parent is not there. That's the traditional justification. And I think some Supreme Court justices have noted that it's kind of deteriorated over time based on mandatory public schooling and schools not necessarily acting as the parents would or in the parents' best interest. But that's kind of the general framework for why schools have a greater control over speech. You could also view it as an organizational necessity in that if you're going to educate minors, immature youth, you're going to need some additional control that would not be appropriate for adults and their free speech rights. So the Sixth Circuit kind of didn't want to take a position on whether or not Tinker does not prohibits viewpoint discrimination per se, which some of the concurrences wanted it to say. I think they didn't want to because it would kind of drastically change how schools could regulate speech, in that some regulations would be per se unlawful based on the reaction to it, which might be a good rule, but it would certainly require a different organization of schools. But what the Sixth Circuit does was identify two extremes, which would be one appropriate for the school to regulate, and then on the other end, not appropriate. So the first, what's not appropriate, is that schools cannot ban student speech just because the audience will suffer discomfort or unpleasantness from hearing ideas they dislike. And so that discomfort and unpleasantness is a quote from Tinker, just based on the audience's reaction to hearing an opinion they don't like, that is not sufficient to regulate speech. On the other end of the extreme of what speech is allowed to be regulated by the school, the majority opinion kind of analyzed it to the categorical unprotected status of some certain categories of speech for adults. So, for example, fighting words, words that provoke an immediate and violent reaction would not be protected. True threats would not be protected even for adults. And so it kind of imported those concepts into the school setting and said that schools likely have greater authority to regulate threatening and abusive speech that's targeted against the student, because those kind of mirror prohibitions on fighting words and true threats. So that was kind of the two ends of the extreme of what is disruption. There's no per se bar on viewpoint discrimination, I'd say, or on the heckler's veto. But you do have to show that there is some, danger to the speech in kind of analogous fashion to true threats and fighting words. And then the second one is the rights of others prong. This prong is very interesting for kind of people who work with Tinker, because it's even since 1969, there have been very few cases that have kind of delved into what are the rights of others. But the majority of the Sixth Circuit interpreted to require schools to identify some source of positive law, including a constitution, a federal statute, or state statute that the speaker violated. But it made clear that no laws give any member of the society the, quote, right to avoid messages they dislike. So again, it can't just be a dislike of the views that is an invasion of the rights, but there must be some protection. The school district here noted Ohio's law prohibiting harassment in schools, and that could maybe give a source of a positive right that would be an invasion of the rights of others.
That's an interesting question that I think all sides were grappling with, sort of when does discomfort and unpleasantness, which would not be sufficient under Tinker, cross the line into harassment or causing disruption to classwork, which would be sufficient under Tinker. And I think the dissent and the majority obviously took different sides of that, at least at the initial stage. So that's really helpful. Can you tell us a bit about the procedural evidentiary question about what the Sixth Circuit imposed? What was the burden of proof and the standard of proof?
So after establishing the two prongs of Tinker, the substantial disruption and the rights of others, the court turned the question, who has to prove that? Because schools don't have to prove that there was an actual disruption. They can rely on a reasonable forecast of disruption. So who bears the burden of proof in that? And the Sixth Circuit concluded, in line with how other circuits had concluded, that the school must prove that there was a disruption, or that there's a reasonable forecast of a disruption, or the forecast that this speech would invade the rights of others. And that is still the burden at the preliminary injunction stage, because the burdens at the preliminary injunction stage generally track the burdens of proof at trial. The more interesting kind of standard of proof issue that the court then turned to was what sort of evidence a school needed depended on the speech that was uttered. So if the schools want to reasonably forecast the disruption from speech that violates the rights of others, the closer the speech resembles fighting words, true threats, defamation, or other unprotected categories of speech, the less evidence the school needs to show that it will likely cause a substantial disruption or invade the rights of others. Conversely, the more protection the First Amendment offers for speech, so political speech is often said to be the most protected form of expression. Religious speech would also qualify. So for those for the greater protection given to speech, the school must show more evidence of an anticipated disruption or invasion of the rights of others. I think the dissent definitely criticizes the majority for this view. It establishes a sliding scale where some speech is given more protection than other speech, even if it for adults, it'd certainly all be protected. So that's an interesting kind of nuance to it. It does mirror some other speech contexts, like in the public employee speech analysis, There's a kind of a sliding scale approach based on the degree of protection offered to the speech. But it's also very different from the categorical First Amendment approach, where the Supreme Court has said that the default is that speech is protected unless the government can show it's in one of these historically unprotected categories, which there are only a few of. And there could be others that, you know, have a long tradition of that. But, you know, so far there's very few. And otherwise, the government really doesn't have much power at all to regulate speech. And so I think this is a valid point of criticism of the majority opinion that the dissent goes into, and we can talk about that later.
Okay, great. So I think you've touched a little bit on it in your remarks there, but can we, let's apply Tinker, having laid out the Tinker test, you know, how did the court apply it to each of the factors? I think, as you mentioned, substantial disruption, they just found no evidence in the record, right?
That's right. Yeah. So having established in a lengthy discussion all the legal principles at play, the court then went on to apply it. So they looked at they said that the school has regulated personal expression that addresses a sensitive topic of public concern. You know, the use of pronouns, which is an ongoing debate, especially in schools, and that involves the students' religious and moral convictions. So that kind of speech is entitled to the utmost protection, I think, as being a religious speech. And it can even be analogized to political speech or speech on a matter of public concern, because this is a policy debate. And the majority also noted, even though it did not take this viewpoint discrimination rule as the legal rule, it noted that the school district has essentially taken a side on the policy debate. It allows and encourages pronouns inconsistent with sex for students that request that, but does not allow pronouns consistent with sex. And so that is taking a side on this important public policy debate. So because the students have this important First Amendment interest, the majority held the school district to a higher standard of evidence based on its discussion of the procedural evidentiary burden. And it found, as you know, Krista, that the school district could not meet it. The school district had essentially offered no evidence of any anticipated disruption or any invasion of the rights of others. So I'll just kind of quickly break down those two prongs. The majority said that the school district was incorrect to treat the use of biological pronouns alone as analogous to this abusive invective that the Supreme Court, you know, that mirrors true threats or fighting words. The students wanted to use these biological pronouns not to ridicule or because they have ill will, but because they want to speak consistent with their notion of the truth, including based on their religious beliefs. And then as a practical matter, students in school cannot avoid using pronouns. That was a point made by the dissent and a point made by others, is that, well, if you don't want to use pronouns inconsistent with sex, just don't use any pronouns. And the school district indicated that it would allow that. And the dissent even made a point of writing the opinion, its dissenting opinion, without using any gendered pronouns at all, as if to show it's possible. And the majority said, well, it's one thing when you have an opinion in formal writing and you can take months to do it, but when students are involved in class, everyday interactions, it's a near impossibility to eliminate pronouns completely from speech. And then the majority finally looked at the fact that the students and their parents acknowledged that the risk that their speech might offend other students. But the Sixth Circuit said that that kind of undifferentiated fear of the possibility of offense does not suffice to allow the school district to prohibit this speech on an important matter, because it is entitled to a lot of protection as being speech. Based on religious and political views or religious and moral views. And then under the rights of others prong, the majority kind of looked to harassment standards, which had been applied in First Amendment adjacent contexts. So it cited the harassment standard from Title IX and the case Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education. And that standard requires that harassing conduct, which could include speech, be severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, so as to deny access to educational opportunities. But there was no evidence that this type of speech had caused any such effects. The majority noted a law review cited by the district court, but said that that wasn't sufficient to meet the evidentiary burden. And it was also, there was also similarly no evidence that this speech violated Ohio's anti-harassment law. And kind of going back to that viewpoint discrimination theme, the majority concluded that the school had attempted to engage in, quote, thought control of its students by picking a certain viewpoint on this debate, and that that's really not the proper role of government in being exactly what the First Amendment protects against. Going back to the Barnett case, the school district cannot compel orthodoxy on important political and religious matters.
Right. And I also found really interesting the conversation about whether the accommodation was sort of illusory or whether it was meaningful. And I think in the oral argument, the defense gave an example. Well, you know, our kids supposed to say, Matt ate Matt's sandwich by Matt's self in Matt's seat. You know, it's pretty contrary to how we usually use grammar and language. And then on the other side, the dissent is saying, you know, there's not a lot of times you're going to need to do this, and you can do this, and it's an accommodation that's meaningful. So I think that's a really interesting discussion. Pardon me if I missed this, but why did the court look to Title IX? You mentioned the severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. Why were they looking at that law?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them is it in that case I mentioned, the Davis case versus Monroe County Board of Education. The court kind of, the majority and dissenting opinion discussed kind of a parallel track of how this harassment standard, which it applied for school district Title IX liability, interacted with the First Amendment. The dissent criticized the majority for kind of ignoring these First Amendment implications, but the majority said that it's appropriate, their standards are appropriately high so as not to include protected speech as harassing conduct, essentially, in that it needs to be a high threshold so that protected speech is not censored by schools because it might be harassment. So there's kind of those First Amendment concerns are implicated there, and other lower courts have applied that standard to free speech claims in school and school policies, most notably in the litigation last year over the Biden administration Title IX rule. This issue came up because the challengers argued that rule adding gender identity would require the use of pronouns inconsistent with sex. And some district court said that's unconstitutional because it doesn't comply with this Davis standard for harassment.
So you mentioned earlier the dissents, accusing the majority of manufacturing a new First Amendment test in this sort of political sliding scale approach, whereby the closer speech resembles political expression, the more evidence a school would need to show potential disruption or violation of rights under Tinker. How fair is that criticism in your view? Did the majority really articulate a new standard for speech in our schools or not?
Yeah, I think it is a fair criticism. I don't think either the dissent or the majority is 100% accurate. The dissent says that the majority created a more amorphous and subjective sliding scale approach that requires schools to provide more evidence to censor political speech. I think that is a fair criticism insofar as the sliding scale approach is a little bit foreign to First Amendment law. It's certainly not used at all in the context outside of school, where the rigid categories of unprotected speech and then everything else is protected. So that's a little bit of a foreign concept. I don't view the majority of those exactly creating a new test, because it's true that the Supreme Court has said that political speech is entitled to the utmost protection. I think it's not exactly clear in those cases involving adult speech how that, if that really matters, because a content-based regulation would be subject to strict scrutiny, no matter if it's, political or not political speech. So I'm not sure how much that matters, but the Supreme Court has said that. And the majority is right that that speech protections apply differently in the lower school context. And there is precedent for a kind of sliding scale approach related to public employee speech. I think the majority rule is good in one manner, in that it does provide protection for political and religious speech, which is very important speech and which is kind of threatened in schools right now. So I think that is helpful. But it's also not clear to me, and I do agree with the dissent, and why for other speech that would certainly be protected outside of schools, there is less evidence that the school needs to regulate that speech. And maybe these things won't come up as often, but I think they will. So I think you could think of, for example, a school district or a student who complains about, you know, the quality of the cafeteria food or doesn't like certain teacher's grading policy. Outside the school, that's definitely protected speech. But inside the school, maybe if it causes some disruption and students are kind of, you know, protesting and they walk out of classes over this grading policy, will that allow the school then to have a lower evidentiary burden to censor that speech because it's not political or religious? Potentially. And I think that's a fair criticism. I think what the majority was trying to do was import the categories of unprotected speech into school, which I do think is the right approach, but I don't think that necessarily requires a sliding scale because you could have just essentially modified categories of unprotected speech in school.
The dissent also tackles the burden of proof that we talked about earlier, saying that all that Tinker requires is that somewhere in the record, regardless of which party put it there, there are facts which might, I'm quoting, which might reasonably have led school authorities to forecast substantial disruption of or material interference with school activities. And the dissent says that, you know, plaintiff's own evidence, I think it was a law review article, of the potential harms to transgender students from being misgendered gave the school sufficient grounds to meet this forecasting standard that educators could say there is, you know, some evidence that this could cause harm. We're not going to wait for that harm to occur. Plaintiff's own evidence shows that that's enough at this stage. What is your response to that?
This one I don't view as fair a criticism. I think the dissent might be right that the court can look to the full record. I think that would make sense. I'm not sure why it matters, especially on a preliminary injunction, that the court kind of assess what evidence is brought in by which party. It's kind of a, seems to me, a holistic inquiry based on what evidence is before the court. But I don't think it's a fair criticism exactly, because I don't think the majority is saying, well, you only look to the evidence that the school district provided. The majority certainly notes that the school district did not provide any evidence, but that doesn't mean that that's not the sole reason that the school district did not meet its evidentiary burden. Because, like you said, what the district court relied on a law review article, and then the dissent kind of picks up this article cited in the preliminary injunction papers by Defending Education. But the article is just a news media report about some, you know, therapists' kind of anecdotal stories about the use of pronouns. So I think the fair reading of the majority's opinion is that, you know, whatever the evidentiary standard is or whoever provides the evidence, there was not any sufficient evidence here, any competent evidence of the school district meeting its interests. So I don't think it's a per se rule that the school district must have this evidence, but the school district does still bear the burden.
What do you make of the dissent's argument that expressing policy views about gender and sex is very, like, in an ivory tower sort of way, is a very different thing from applying those views directly to a fellow student? And I think the dissent used the analogy that expressing views about immigration, in, you know, writ large, is different from telling, you know, John students, immigrants, you don't belong here in this country. So I think the dissent's argument was that, you know, the latter could cross the line into harassment under Tinker, where the former, you know, is protected. And she acknowledged that, you know, under this policy, students could wear a T-shirt that said there are two genders only, and that would be them expressing their opinions on the subject. So what do you make of that point by the dissent?
I think it's an important distinction, the targeted nature of language versus just discussing issues in the abstract. And I think it has legal significance. No judge on the Sixth Circuit disputed that schools have an interest and an ability to regulate harassment and bullying. I think the problem and the real divide between the majority and the dissent is how we define these terms. So even though the children of the Defending Education members wanted to use pronouns consistent with sex in respect to individual students, And so it could be viewed as targeted in a sense. The majority said that that does not rise to the level of harassment, which has to be a decently high standard in order to protect First Amendment speech. So I think the targeted nature, or if you're talking about specific students, it does matter because there can be harassment and bullying, which the school can and should regulate. And targeting, or you know, being in regards to a specific student is a factor in that analysis, but it's not dispositive in that analysis, as the dissent would contend. And the second point on that, which the majority notes, is that the general rule in the First Amendment is that you cannot, the government can't censor you in one area and say, well, you can go, you know, speak over there if you want to. The First Amendment leaves the choice of how we want to speak to the individual. And so even though I could wear a t-shirt to school saying this, if I want to express the same view in a different way, that's really my First Amendment right. And the government independently has to meet its burden if it wants to censor my expression on that basis. And so I think for those two reasons, this distinction between targeting and in general speech matters to some extent, but is not dispositive of the legal questions.
Coming back for a moment, and then we'll open up to some audience questions if folks want to type any questions into the comments. The dissent argues that there was no compelled speech in the case because the students were given the choice when, you know, again, whether it was illusory or overly burdensome is up for debate, but they were given the choice to use last names to refer to students who didn't want traditional pronouns. You know, it occurs to me, and I think it was discussed a bit in the writings, that by using only last names, the students will be giving an unspoken but unmistakable signal of their belief that sex is immutable, which is itself could be seen as compelling speech. I don't think the majority got into this. As you mentioned, they didn't go the compelling speech out, but it'll be an interesting one as the case works its ways through the court. It occurs to me there was a California business reporting law proposed a while back where they would ask social media companies, require them, in fact, to, if they use terms like hate speech, to take us to basically define those terms. How do you define hate speech? And, you know, the concern there is you're requiring those companies, those private actors, to essentially disclose how they feel about a certain fraught topic. And I see a rough parallel here, potentially. I don't think the court talked a lot about that, but I wonder if you have any thoughts about the compelled speech angle if it comes up, you know, on another appeal later down the line.
Yeah, I think it's a very important issue. I don't agree with the dissent's characterization here of the compelled speech angle. In fact, the brief ADF submitted, the amicus brief ADF submitted in this case, dealt with the issue of compelled speech. And that's based on a previous Sixth Circuit case, Meriwether versus Hartop, that ADF litigated, which dealt with a similar pronoun policy directive for a professor at a college in Ohio. And so the university there argued that the professor could comply with its policy by not using any pronouns or sex-based terms like Mr. or Miss, but using last names like that. And the university there argued that that wouldn't violate his religious beliefs. But the Sixth Circuit in that case noted two errors in that reasoning, in that the first is it would prohibit the professor from speaking in accordance with his religious beliefs, as in he wanted to use sex-reflective pronouns and titles, but he couldn't. And the Sixth Circuit then cited the Supreme Court case of Riley versus National Federation of the Blind to note that the Supreme Court said there's no constitutional significance between compelled speech and compelled silence. So that's something that Judge Batchelter noted in her dissent at the panel stage and in the concurrence, that you're forcing the students, you're compelling the students to stay silent on the issues of pronouns when they'd rather speak. And so that's saying there's kind of no compelled are no constitutional distinction between compelled speech and compelled silence in that respect. And then the second is goes back to that kind of impossibility point, which is that eliminating pronouns from your speech is effectively impossible, especially in the classroom setting. And so the dissent in this case notes that, well, the students don't have to take away all pronouns, they can just not use pronouns with regards to transgender identifying students. But again, I don't think, you know, maybe that kind of reduces the burden or the difference, but it still is, I guess, compelling silence on this issue and forcing them not to say something they wouldn't otherwise say, which is a form of compelled speech. And then on your point about, you know, that the last name kind of still conveys their opinion, I think that's true in a sense. But again, I think the First Amendment protects the message that the speaker, him or herself, wants to convey, not necessarily one that the school finds appropriate and still, you know, believes in its own estimation to be consistent with the beliefs of the student. So I think it should rightly focus on a student-centric analysis.
Great. Well, I'm going to turn to a couple audience questions before we wrap up today. One pertains to the subjective intent inquiry that the court discussed, this idea that, you know, the intentional use of pronouns consistent with sex to a student who doesn't want those pronouns would violate the policy. And the question is, under the majority opinion, how would a school distinguish racially, ethnically, or sexually / gender charged language that might be perceived as insulting, generally like slurs? Would that be perceived malicious intent? I think sort of grappling with, you know, obviously a subjective intent inquiry could be applied to other categories of offensive speech too. Do you have any responses to that?
Right. Two points on that. One, I think the fact that the students, and the majority cited this a couple of times, had no ill will towards other students. I'm not sure how legally dispositive that is. I think it's a factor. I think the majority was saying that to show, you know, kind of be sympathetic and indicate how they're not trying to antagonize anyone. This is just the expression of their beliefs. And so it's kind of like a background helpful for the story in conveying a positive story. So I think that's one aspect of it. The other one, too, is that I think their intent could be an element of anti-harassment, anti-bullying statutes. And could be properly applied as in if you have an intent to target the student and an intent to demean the student, that could be one element. So I think that could be appropriate. But regardless of that, there still needs to be kind of an objectively high standard for what is harassment and bullying, like the Davis standard, severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, so as to deny an educational opportunity. It's necessary to have that objective standard because it goes back to Tinker that, you know, the mere offense or unpleasantness of a certain view does not give a sufficient basis to censor it. So there actually has to be some adverse impact, not just a dislike with the views. And so even an intent element alone doesn't necessarily give that. There has to be some objective characteristics. So I think the intent is important, but not dispositive.
To some extent, that relates to another question in the chat about, I think, the balance between adverse impact and intent. We have a very diverse country, obviously, and what, you know, you might say might offend me and not somebody else based on cultural or religious differences. So I think I hear you saying, you know, where the line is it's got to be both an intent on the speaker's part and in fact, an adverse impact in the school setting that wouldn't impact school and learning. One is not sufficient without the other.
Yeah, I think there definitely has to be an adverse impact. As to intent, I'm not sure if it's like a legally required element, but I think it is a certain element that could be applied by schools. So, but there definitely has to be that adverse impact. And, the Supreme Court has said in that BL case, I noted the most recent student speech case that schools are, quote, nurseries of democracy. And as the question pointed out, you know, in this kind of very diverse society where a lot of different types of people interact in public schools. The point is that they kind of learn from one another. And so people will say things that you don't like. I think the proper response is not to complain to the school officials that you don't like it and they should stop it, but rather to either challenge them, learn from their perspective, or share your own perspective, even for students, because that's really how we learn.
There's a question in the chat. It's a long question. I think it gets to the issue of, you know, did the court address or bring into its calculation the issue of whether schools have an obligation to teach the question or phrase it as the truth. I think I might add, you know, fact-based discussions about biological differences between the sexes. Was that type of evidence or discussion brought up at all in the decision about pronoun use? And I think not, but if not, do you think it would come in a later stage of the case, or is that irrelevant to the First Amendment, you know, framework?
Yeah, that type of evidence I don't believe was before the en banc court about, you know, the school teachings or what the school should teach. It's interesting, as Krista, as you pointed out in an earlier question, that the school district itself said, well, you can express this opinion. You can wear a shirt that there are only two genders. Like, you could talk about this issue. We don't prevent you from doing that. You just can't do this thing that we view to be bad. So there is kind of some aspect of that that the school district recognized that students could express this view. But as opposed to like what the normative thing is and what the school itself is teaching, I don't think that evidence was in the record. It might have been. It was not discussed by the en banc court. Would it come up later? I think it could potentially come up later. You know, there's the Mahmoud versus Taylor case recently from the Supreme Court about the kind of curricula that is being taught in public schools, unfortunately. I don't know if it's in this school, but, you know, in general, and there could be where the school district takes a side on the controversy through its curriculum and what it's requiring of students. And I think that could be evidence, maybe further evidence of viewpoint discrimination. But I don't believe it's going to be a substantive issue in this case itself, because it really focuses on the First Amendment right of the students.
Comment just came in. How would this ruling apply to cases challenging schools imposing orthodoxy with regard to masking, like facial coverings or vaccine requirements in COVID context, particularly where, as here, the science is controverted and unsettled?
Yeah, it's, you know, the Barnett case is about, it has a famous and soaring language about the school can't compel orthodoxy and force belief and its ideas about religion, politics, etc. And that's a paraphrase, so don't quote me on that. But, you know, there is that soaring language. But I think what the concern of Barnett, and then the concern of these other First Amendment cases, including the Sixth Circuit case here, was really ideological speech. So it's not just force compelling to do anything, but in that case, Barnett, it was the forced salute to the flag and recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance, which the court held implicated the First Amendment. So, you know, I think that those kind of the masking issues like that are not really First Amendment issues, because I don't think, you know, masking is not, it doesn't have, really have a speech interest there. So I don't think that this decision would apply to those. It's also a separate question from what schools can teach in the curriculum, because I think at some level, at any level, the curriculum, there is that kind of indoctrination and inculcation of values, like this is, you know, how we're going to teach you. And this is not offering a kind of opt out or something like that, because again, the majority applied the Tinker standard, which relates to students' personal expression. So the kind of curriculum challenges are different sorts of cases, which often involve harder legal challenges.
Well, that's great. Hopefully we did a good job briefing this case. I appreciate all your insights, Matthew. I think that's all I have for you today. So, in the absence of further audience questions, I guess we will wrap it up.
Sounds good. Well, thank you both so much for taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. We really appreciate taking the section of your morning or your afternoon and taking the time to be with us. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.